The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors: Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card that generates leads. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet and Fetch Pro, the secure, high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. And Printify, the online, on-demand print shop for all your corporate merchandise. Be sure to visit our online store and get your own podcast merch. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
But the podcast, I did the podcast because I thought, you know what, I need to, it was slightly cathartic. I don't know if you get this, Mitch, but sometimes when you do these things, I don't just do interviews as well. I speak, you know, my first 30 episodes was just me just speaking into a microphone. And it was cathartic because I started to talk about all the things I'd experienced. I talked about the key components of scale up, and I also talked a lot about mindset and belief systems and all those things. And that was kind of to fill my contribution bucket up a bit. I needed to help people without any expectation for a while because I'd sucked so much life out of people for years. And
just to make yourself feel better.
Well, it was a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was. There's a thing here where
humanity, you got to put it back now.
Well, yeah, and there's a thing here, but people say that, you know, if you want to be really happy and fulfilled in life, you've got to have both a level of personal growth and contribution.
And
I had a lot of other things going on. I did have a fair bit of personal growth, but I wasn't helping enough people. I wasn't feeling like I was adding enough value to the world.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit beinhackerlaw.com or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hi, I'm Nick Bradley. I'm an entrepreneur, investor, and business growth expert. My company, Scale Up Your Business, works exclusively with entrepreneurs and investors, transforming good companies into great ones. Over the last few years, I've built, bought, and sold 22 businesses with a combined value of $5.2 billion. And I'm currently in the process of scaling my podcast globally after being ranked number one business podcast in the UK on iTunes and Spotify. My bigger vision is to help leaders build empires so they can make a bigger impact utilizing the skill set and mindset of entrepreneurship as a driving force of progression and prosperity.
All right, Nick Bradley, thanks for coming on the podcast from across the pond, right? You're in England?
Mitch, I am. Listen, thanks for having me on the show, man. I'm really looking forward to our conversation this evening.
I appreciate it. Now, you have to stay focused, right? Because you said you just got back from Greece, is it? This is to piss off all the people.
You know what?
Yeah,
it's funny, right? It's funny. I've got a tan, right? Yeah. And I spent 2 weeks in a place called Corfu, which is one of the Greek islands, where in terms of temperature, I'm not sure what it is in Fahrenheit, but in Celsius, it's like 32 to 33 degrees, which has got to be what, in the 80s or 90s?
Yeah, something like that, like perfect weather.
And I'll tell you this just quickly before we kind of kick off properly is I was there for 2 weeks, but it took me a week just to kind of unwind. after everything that's been happening over the last few months, I've been so busy with business and whatever. And then I started feeling guilty for unwinding. And then it was probably the last 3 days that I started reading a book.
So it was time to come back. It was time to come back. But that's what people should understand. If you can become a real entrepreneur where you got growing business, you get to go to Greece for 2 weeks in the middle of a pandemic. So
that's right. Yeah, there is an upside.
Yeah. Good to have you back. I hope you didn't like cut your vacation short just to make this podcast episode, did you?
I would have done that for you, Mitch. Come on.
You could have dialed in on your phone from the pool in Greece.
I could have done all that. It was an extraordinarily good trip, partly because I think, you know, you forget the luxuries and the flexibilities and things like that we have before the whole pandemic stuff. And when you start to have those freedoms and constraints put on you, then it's the things like just getting away, a simple trip, which become much more rewarding. So I'm very grateful to be able to get away in this time.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States, you got to think about what state you're going to go to, because you might have to quarantine for 2 weeks when you come back. You got to work, you got to do, you know, whatever. So yeah, it's not my wife. So she usually goes to the grocery store. So, you know, not both of us are getting exposed to things. She takes my son to college in Indiana, comes back for 2 weeks. She couldn't leave the house. So, you know,
well, we just missed that. So what was happening here? So we're in the sort of melting pot of Europe. So everything, you know, pretty much most of Europe or Western Europe fits across the whole of North America anyway. And they were basically banning countries or having the 2 week quarantine.
Yeah, the whole country, you couldn't go.
Okay. Yeah. And of course, Greek islands, there's heaps of them, right? So what we were getting annoyed about was that we were on one that had like one COVID case in the last few weeks, whereas all these party guys were going to Mykonos and they were getting like plane full.
I'm sure.
So the government.
But it's the same rule, right? Because you're part of Greece. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But they changed it. Basically, they decided to now segregate via islands, as opposed to saying the whole country, which was a much more sensible approach.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. So now you're back and now you're back in the swing of things. And I've been looking forward to us talking about all the stuff that you've done and you're doing and the people that you're helping and your podcast, which you promised me we'll do some collaborations on. And I'm going to hold you to that. And let's go back though. Let's go back to your background and, you know, how you were raised, or, you know, what you grew up learning, how, you know, how you became an entrepreneur. I'm sure there's a story there. So
I'm happy to share it. I won't bore everybody by going back too far.
We got an hour. Don't worry about it.
There is an early stage part here, which I think is important. So I grew up in a little town called Adelaide in South Australia.
Okay.
And it's famous for three things. Churches. It's got heaps of churches. Like, you've never seen so many church spires in your life. Really big, great white sharks. In fact, a lot of the scenes from Jaws, the open water scenes, some of that was filmed in South Australia.
I didn't know that. Okay.
And serial killers.
Perfect.
At one point, this is all true.
I don't know what's more dangerous. Swimming with the sharks, the serial killers, or going to church.
I have no affiliation with any of those things. Although I do know someone who was taken by a shark and never came back.
That's a story.
That is a story in its own right. But anyway, I grew up in this little town. And I, at an early age, I was kind of quite overweight, and I was basically, I mean, I don't know what it is in pounds, but in kilograms, I was like 110, 120 kilos.
At what age?
At age 10.
Okay.
So that's going to be about what, 260, 270 pounds?
That's a lot.
Oh yeah, I was big, man. And but to put it in context, I now weigh something like 75 kilograms.
You're a thin guy.
Yeah. So I went through this stage when I was younger where I was overweight for various reasons and I got bullied quite a lot. And I didn't have a lot of stability in my home life, right? Because my father had left and my mum was getting remarried. There's all sorts of things like that, which have a bit of a backstory. But the interesting thing was I had to sort of transform myself out of this situation of being quite a lot of pain, certainly from the bullying and also just feeling not very good in terms of self-esteem.
Pain, right?
Yeah, very much into something else. And I did that through the ages of sort of 11, 12, sort of 13. I lost all the weight. I became an athlete, got very, very good at basketball and rowing, represented my school in those sports.
Okay.
And I became fixated in this concept between your physicality can affect your mindset. And the more congruent those two things are, can then manage your emotional state.
Right.
And the reason I share that story is I went from that to basically starting my first business at 18. So I became an entrepreneur in the traditional sense at 18. and that business was a personal training studio back in the late 80s.
With what you're doing, right?
Yeah, late 80s.
Now, what do you think? What do you think changed or clicked? Because there's a lot of kids in that position where they're bullied and they're overweight and they're not. And, you know, I had a cousin who did that too. And she just one day, I don't know what happened. She lost all this weight, took care of herself. She looked great. She had all kind of self-esteem back and feeling good about herself. So what do you think like clicked or changed in your mind where you just said, I'm doing this?
Yeah, I studied psychology at university later on, and there's a thinking here or a concept here, which is quite interesting, that if you have either extremes of pain or pleasure,
right,
that will force you to take action. If you live in mediocrity,
you don't feel any pressure to accept it. Exactly.
What it was for me, there was a trip that I went to up to the Gold Coast, sort of Queensland area of Australia, where I was just out, not doing much at this resort with my family. And I got pulled aside by these kids.
You're what age now? 12, 13?
Around about nine.
Young. Okay.
And I'm very overweight.
Yeah.
And these kids pulled me aside and started teasing me and then literally beat the crap out of me.
And they were about your age too?
I had to go to hospital and get sort of, you know, looked after there.
Yeah.
And I was also getting bullied at school and all this sort of stuff. And I just made a decision, Mitch. I said, you know what?
Never again.
I'm not going to get help from anyone.
Right.
I'm going to have to work this out myself. So it was around 9 or 10, I think, but certainly around that age, I then thought I need to take control. So it came from a position of pain and saying enough is enough that made me make that transition.
Yeah. You hit bottom. It's like, what's the analogy? Like if you're on an island in Greece, right? And you're all happy, everything's wonderful. And somebody comes by and says, hey, we have a better island over here. You're like, okay. I mean, I'm safe. Everything's fine here. But if they said, oh, here's all the seismic charts, there's a volcano underneath your island, it's going to blow up in 4 days, you would leave. So I guess force you in your mind to say,
you need leverage. And you know, the way I explain this story a little bit sometimes when people ask is, because I had a person I was working with, a client who gave up smoking, and he gave up smoking when his daughter asked him the question, his young daughter, his sort of 7 or 8 year old daughter, said to him, you know, daddy, you're going to die from cancer. And he'd attempted to give up smoking for years, but never done it until that one moment. And the pain of that question, if you like, or the repercussions of that question forced the action. He never went back.
Right.
So it's a similar thing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I'm sorry. I wanted to know like where.
No, it's fine.
People listening will be like, I can't do that.
And you'll
be like,
no, yeah, well, I tell that story because, and, you know, the transformation was interesting because I didn't have a lot of stability. I had a very.
Right. Makes it harder, right?
Yeah, I had strong influence from my grandfather around that time. He was a very strong man and very traditional in terms of, right, he wouldn't know how to help, but he was like, just kind of get your shit together sort of stuff.
Right.
As a 10-year-old.
That's how we did growing up, tough love.
Yeah, it was, but it was good. Yeah. It was very powerful. And the reason I tell that story, obviously, is that that then inspired me to kind of make physicality, fitness, energy, those sort of things, part of my identity. And then I turned that into a business. I started that business, as I said, in the late 80s, early 90s. And back then, personal training was not like it is now. I mean,
no, the fact I was that just you would, coming out of college. We had gyms we would go to, but there's no personal training.
No. And you know, we're not talking in Venice Beach, California here. We're talking in Adelaide, South Australia, right?
Right.
But I built a pretty successful business for the time. I had effectively, I was doing about 30 hours a week of one-to-one training. I had two staff members. I hired a private studio within a gym. And I was working with very successful business leaders, doctors, lawyers, people who could afford personal training and also could understand the concept. They were time poor, cash rich.
Right.
And I did that for 3 years and then I sold the business. Okay. And I left Adelaide and went to Sydney, and that's a whole nother chapter, Mitch. But to your question, that was my first
part two of the podcast later on.
It probably is. That was my start as an entrepreneur, as an 18-year-old who kind of just fell into it, to be frank.
And how long did you stay in Australia?
I stayed in Australia until 2003. So I went from Adelaide to Sydney. I had a very, very full-on corporate career working for News International, Rupert Murdoch's empire. And then I got the opportunity to transfer from Australia to the UK to work for another big consumer publishing magazine empire, the biggest consumer publisher in the UK at the time. So I was flying up the ranks in the world of corporate for about 10 years there.
Got it. Okay. So your job brought you to England and then you've stayed ever since.
Yeah, met my wife and now, you know, two daughters later and the rest of right. it, that's what happens. Exactly. But I did do a stint in your neck of the woods. I was in New York for about a year working for a company called Getty Images.
Sure.
And that was my first move into the
world. As an attorney, I'm very familiar with Getty Images. I get clients, these letters all the time. This is our image. And they go, what?
Yeah, that's what they like. No, but you know, massive. I mean, that was my first move into private equity properly. And I learned a lot from being involved in that because in private equity, it's just a different corporate's interesting, but there's lots of different things going on. It's not maybe not quite as clear as what private equity is set up to do. And then after that, so we're talking now about 2009, I spent the last decade working in private equity or around VC and private equity in those areas.
So you, what did you do? You went to work for a VC or a private equity company, or you got involved in deals? What were you doing?
Combination of things. What ended up happening is in my stint in the world of corporate, I became pretty well regarded for going into businesses or business units, you could say, that weren't optimized and fixing them.
Got it.
And I did that from a commercial standpoint, product, sales, marketing, but also from a general leadership. You know, I was on the board of a couple of these bigger corporates.
A little bit of kind of like a turnaround guy.
Yeah, I was becoming known as a bit of a turnaround guy. And of course, that's a very valuable role in private equity. A lot of private equity businesses are invested in and then they go backwards and they want someone who can go in there and operationally turn these things around.
Of course, that's what they're buying for, right? They're buying depressed value that they think they can fix.
Absolutely. You know, scale up, bolt together, create synergy, you know, that sort of stuff. So as I had a reputation for that, there was a natural pull from corporate to private equity. And I first got involved in a kind of operating capacity, sort of as a senior leader within a couple of invested companies.
Got it.
And then I ended up becoming CEO of a couple of smaller PE-backed businesses. I was involved in a few exits through that process. So scaling them up and selling them. And then again, just got a reputation for going in there and working at a level of precision, clinical precision, which some elements of that I'm pretty proud of and some elements I'm not. Okay. But I was very much the prototypical private equity model. You know, have you ever seen Billions?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, Bobby Axelrod. I was kind of, you know, I wasn't Bobby Axelrod, but no, I was in that mold.
He was a hedge fund guy, yeah.
But I was a bit like that. You know, I could go into those situations and I could analyze things and I could take action.
I mean, you were a dick? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I was. I was going to use a more polite term. Like,
yeah, we're not on live radio. So,
I was relentless, man. And that's partly why I made some changes after that stint. And what I do now, the whole scale up your business thing and all of that, was another transformation, not dissimilar to what I did as a 10, 11-year-old. But I had to take all the learning I had from corporate and private equity and I needed to create something different because that world, as much as it can be very lucrative, you can make a lot of money, it can be quite toxic depending on how you approach it.
Right. Well, were you at the point where you just weren't happy with who you felt you were at that point? You're like,
yeah,
you know, in terms of what it came down to, you'd become? Yeah.
What it came down to was this. I think I was a bit of a frustrated entrepreneur anyway. So as I said, I started a business when I was young and then I went into the world of corporate. And that's kind of interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, most entrepreneurs, once they get the bug.
I never really could make it in corporate. It was just too hard.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of what happened. Now, funnily enough, I got promoted very quickly because I was a bit of an arsehole all the way through. And I would always say what people were too scared to say.
Right.
And for certain audiences,
corporate, I guess, right? People are scared.
It got me to a certain level in corporate because it got me standing out because everyone else is, you know, looking for certainty and looking for safety. And I wasn't that person. But there's a certain level within corporate that if you get up to a board level or regional level, if you're too chippy and then, you know, too opinionated, then that doesn't work. Right. And so my transition into private equity was a natural one, because in private equity, you can kind of be a bit more assertive and it's respected. But then you start to realize that you start to become all the good things, but also all the bad things about that world. You know, I won't go into too much of the detail, but I've sat in boardrooms and seen decisions made in the private equity landscape, which means that any of the people in the businesses are never going to make any money.
Right.
That there's a lot of, you know, mistruths and all sorts of things that happen just because people are relentless. Or certainly back, you know, a few years ago, it was much more like that. And I just wasn't, happy with the person I was becoming in that environment.
Now, do you remember the first private equity deal, the first company you came in as an executive on? What did it do?
Yeah, so I worked across sort of education and education technology. So my background previous was media, which you could argue is content, valuable content, and I was moving that content into education, as education is actually one of the last industries to be disrupted properly by technology. So you had media and retail sort of in the sort of 2000s, and then ed tech. And to some extent, fintech has been a little bit more laggard in that world, right?
Right.
So I came from having gone through disruption to move into an area where I could add value. So I was sort of MD and CEO of a number of businesses, which were education technology, either were going to become ed tech businesses and were traditional education businesses,
right?
Or were there was a vision to create a group around that sort of human capital and education niche, if you like.
Yeah, I think the problem with ed tech is the lack of resources. I mean, fintech, they have money, so they're going to, you know, use technology and improve their business. Ed tech, a lot of it's public, so
yeah. And you've got what you've got.
We have no technology.
No, and the area I focused on was corporate learning. So I was working with Google for a while, and I was working with some. I mean, the last exit that I was involved in was a company called Ascend Learning. And we sold that for just over $2 billion to Blackstone. And so that gives you, I mean, there's a lot of value in the space now. That was in 2017. Right. So there's money there. There's definitely money there, because people are starting to prove that using technology and data in learning can drive results and impact. And that was never something that could be proved previously without the use of those two kind of areas.
Well, Google certainly positioned themselves well by giving it away in a Google Classroom. And now, holy shit, they couldn't ask for this pandemic to come at the right time. I mean, my God, everything's Google Classroom. It's all, there's no Microsoft in the schools.
No, it's all Google. It's massive. Listen, it was a fun ride. So, but I got to a point where I wasn't really showing up in the way that I wanted to show up at home with the family. I wasn't present. Everything was about the deal. And then what happened is one evening I went to sleep and I woke up at about 3 a.m. and my whole jaw, it was like I'd been bitten by something or I'd fallen out of bed or whatever else, but my whole jaw was like throbbing and swollen. And I went to the bathroom and it looked like I'd been punched in the face, like literally. And so I kind of tried to get back to sleep, took painkillers or whatever else, but I went to the doctor in the morning and he said, you got to go to the dentist. So I went to the dentist, and what I'd done, right, this is crazy, is I cracked the three areas of my teeth in the back part here of my jaw.
Grinding them while you're sleeping?
Well, yeah, that's the sort of the slow version of what normally people do when they're stressed. I broke the teeth off.
In one night?
Yes.
Oof.
I must have, the only time someone had ever seen this before was sort of what I was going through, which was just, we were doing a deal, a lot of stress. I was not probably looking after myself in the way that I do now. And I was holding on to that stress and I was just getting the physical reaction of it to the point where I just broke the teeth.
Ugh. God,
mental, right?
Painful.
And so I sort of said to my wife after that, I said, I've got to change this. We're going to get out of this.
Well, stress, I mean, it's like the worst. I mean, there's a lot of bad things in the world for you. Stress is the worst. Yeah. It manifests itself in all kinds of ways that you don't realize.
It does. It becomes physical. And, you know, people talk about, you know, getting diseases like cancer and whatever else because of stress. And I can see that because
it lowers your immune. Yeah. You're just totally exposed because of
that. Yeah. Pent up energy in the wrong areas too. I decided to get out of it. So this is the thing that I did.
Fixed your teeth first though, right? So
still not great. Still not great. Yeah. My jaw is still, you know, I can still remember that night. But what happened was this is the thing that was happening. Like, you know, if you look back on stuff, I believe that these sort of circumstances become a gift, right? You know, you kind of look and see the good in them.
Yeah. And silver linings. There's always a reason for everything.
Yeah, right? There is. And what was happening is I was sitting on the private equity side of the table watching a lot of entrepreneurs get taken advantage of. And if you step above all of what we're talking about tonight for a second, it makes a lot of sense that private equity guys are usually very sharp, very, very good with their numbers, their spreadsheet guys, all that. A lot of entrepreneurs don't come from that. They come from, you know, creativity, right. Solving a problem. Sometimes they're technically proficient in certain things, but they're not necessarily financially always that strong. And so I was seeing a lot of these people selling their businesses, but not getting the value for that.
Because they didn't understand what they had.
Didn't understand. And the private equity guys, it's improved a lot in the last few years. But back, you know, 5 years ago, let's say a little bit more, 5 to 10 years ago, it was a bit of a badge of honor for the PE guys to kind of just, you know, do a bit more exploitative stuff.
Right.
And that was just starting to grind me down, literally. And anyway, so I thought, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to change this. I'm going to go and work on the side of the entrepreneur, the business leader, and I'm going to help them grow and scale their business. And with the whole intention of you know, creating valuable exits for these people, the ability to build empires, to create impact, all that.
Yeah, to monetize all that you've built, because that's always the part that's kind of overlooked, right?
Monetize and
how do you
make
get out?
And,
how do you?
And also to do it the right way. To do it the right way, because it's a little bit like these people just didn't have the support. And to be frank, the stuff I do now, not a lot of people do. But the more you get into it, the more you realize the value that's needed there.
Yeah. So how do you? What do? You come up to a guy that you were doing a deal with and say, "Hey, these guys are taking advantage of you. Would you call me and we'll figure it out?" And then you start coaching these guys. I mean, how'd that?
I couldn't do it while I'm working for a PE firm.
Right.
I mean, what happened was this. I decided that everything I'd done for the last 20 years was go into companies and, as I said, operate with a level of precision in the areas where they need to be improved.
Right.
And I'm very clear. There's six areas in a business that usually causes a business to fall down or to not create value. And I'm pretty clear now about how you can improve each of those areas and how you can diagnose issues. So what I did is I did the podcast. I thought, you know what,
you're going to tell us at some point what those six areas are?
Yeah.
Just leave me hanging.
No, I'll just leave you hanging.
Okay.
No, of course I'll get into it, but the podcast, I did the podcast because I thought, you know what, I need to, it was slightly cathartic. I don't know if you get this, Mitch, but sometimes when you do these things, I don't just do interviews as well. I speak, you know, my first 30 episodes was just me just speaking into a microphone, and it was cathartic because I started to talk about all the things I'd experienced. I talked about the key components of scale up, and I also talked a lot about mindset and belief systems and all those things. And that was kind of to fill my contribution bucket up a bit. I needed to help people without any expectation for a while because I'd sucked so much life out of people for years. Yeah. And
just to make yourself feel better.
Well, it was a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was. There's a thing here
where humanity, you got to put it back now.
Well, yeah, and there's a thing here, but people say that, you know, if you want to be really happy and fulfilled in life, you've got to have both a level of personal growth and contribution.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of other things going on. I did have a fair bit of personal growth, but I wasn't helping enough people. I wasn't feeling like I was adding enough value to the world. So to your question, I started the podcast. It had a lot of very early success in terms of downloads and rankings and people reaching out to me, more than I expected. And off the back of that, I built a number of different businesses. Some of that is mentoring. Some of that is bringing high-level experts into businesses and doing the work that's required to fix problems and do the scale-up. Because a lot of people, one of the problems I think with the world is that these days is everyone's doing a bloody online course. And the issue is if I speak to an entrepreneur, they don't really always want that. They want the job done. They want the output, the outcome.
Right.
So I created a whole ecosystem out of the concept of scale up your business to work with entrepreneurs on this journey. And what's happened since then is that investors have now come to us and said, we want you to help us, but I'm very clear, I'll help them in the right way. I won't go in there and partake in the kind of, you know, we're just here to screw over our portfolio right. companies.
Well, you could set the rules now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's my business, right? I can choose who I work with. I'm not beholden to anybody.
Right.
And a lot of the more progressive private equity firms that are out there now love that model. You know, this idea of conscious capitalism and the idea that you've got to have a bit more of a set of proper values behind what you do.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something to be said about social entrepreneurism and caring about the planet, caring about the people. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems in business. We don't run companies in a lot of cases. Like, people matter. But take the people off the planet and there's no companies. There's nothing going on. It's just a dead planet. So I think, and there's some big corporations that unfortunately, you know, they're driven by their numbers, right? So you basically use the podcast kind of like from a thought leadership standpoint to, you know, develop a community to start working with the people on the other side of the table that you wanted to work with.
I realized that I needed to, you know, stop hiding behind all my experience, and I needed to build my own brand around what I wanted to achieve. So you could argue, if you go full circle for what we spoke about at the beginning of this conversation, you know, I became an entrepreneur when I started my first business at 18. I kind of went and did a whole heap of stuff in between that. And then I became an entrepreneur again, or more entrepreneurial again, when I started to create these businesses after I decided to leave the world of corporate and PE.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000, that's L-A-W to 21000, to learn how to get your own digital business card. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their affiliate link on our website to learn more and get connected with Fetch. Printify is the online service that simplifies and automates the process of sourcing and creating print-on-demand products branded with your company logo, product, or service. Printify is a better alternative to pre-purchasing and warehousing your merchandise for distribution or sale. Follow their link from our website to learn how to set up your own online store. And be sure to visit our online store and get yourself some podcast merch. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
So I feel much more congruent now because I've actually gone back to probably what I should have done 20 years ago.
Right, right. Well, you know, you need balance in your life and peace and quality. And so tell me about some of the companies that you have worked with, work with, or involved with. Well, let's start with what you've worked with when you got started, and then we'll get to what you're doing today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll talk about the six peaks of value creation as well, just so I don't leave you hanging on that.
Yeah, please.
So, I mean, I don't work across any specific sectors. So I don't sit there and say that I'm a retail or an ed tech specialist.
Okay.
I filter businesses more by the stage of where they are. And I filter clients by mindset more than I do about anything else. Because this is the thing I've sort of learned through this whole process is the mechanics, you know, which we'll talk around, they're relatively straightforward. You know, anything I say tonight is not necessarily something you would have heard differently before. I might position it slightly differently, but you know what it is, right? Most of the listeners.
The mechanics and the basics are the same. Yeah.
But it's the thing that usually falls down is that the person leading the business doesn't realize that they have to change their identity through the various stages of that growth. So I often say a person who's brilliant at starting a business is not necessarily the best at scaling it, because it takes a very, very different skill set and mindset.
Well, you see that very common in businesses. When the businesses really start to grow, they get thrown out, or the smart ones step aside or whatever.
Yeah, it's, well, Google, totally, when was it Eric Schmidt? I think who was the first CEO of Google? The guy, anyway, there was a guy that was brought in by
Because the two guys started it in a garage.
Yeah.
Who weren't capable of running a multi-billion dollar corporation.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes that founder can be very, very effective as the leader. And you see the Steve Jobs stuff. Now, you know, there's a bit there where
he came back, right?
Exactly. But he was such an iconic leader in what he was good at. He still needed to have the right leadership team around him.
Right.
But people often ask me, what's the definition of scale up? And for me, it's about the ability to deal with complexity. So you've still got to keep things simple as your world is becoming more complex. It's the ability to manage your own emotional state through that complexity.
Right.
And it's about the ability to build culture and build teams.
Sure. That's what a leader does.
Yeah. And you know, think about scale up. What really is it? Well, it's not two guys in a garage. It's a company which is effectively going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of employees at some point, particularly if you're trying to build an empire.
Right.
So if you think about what's needed there, that's an interesting place. So I come in, where I come in is usually where the business has plateaued or stalled. It can still be seven figures. Usually seven figures is
right, but you're not there in the startup phase.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no way.
I tend to take a business early stage for you. Yeah, I tend to take a business from seven, sometimes eight figures to a 9 to 10 figure exit.
Well, that's true. I mean, you got to grow from the startup to the point where you can scale. You want them when the point where they can scale, and then you can work with them.
Yeah, exactly. And quite often these businesses, that's why I say I work with businesses that are good businesses, but they're not great businesses.
Right.
And you need to define the difference between that. And that's where we go into these kind of six categories, these six peaks of value. So, let me talk about those. So the way I contextualize this is when I was looking at investment, and as I look at investment now, I say I've got seven companies now and I buy businesses and do all sorts of stuff. I always look through these six lenses, if you like, to see which areas need to be optimized or which areas are working well.
Right.
And the first one, which is a very simplistic concept, is I put it under the concept of purpose. But it's effectively, does the business, does the leader have a clear vision, and do they have a compelling plan, sometimes called a strategy, to achieve it?
Okay.
And again, simple. Well, of course, every business has got a vision. Every business has got a plan. But you know what?
It was in writing, though.
Well,
you know.
Here's the thing, right?
Or it's scattered all over the place. You know what I mean?
Well, there's two things I see more often than not. The plan is too complex. The vision
trying
is
to do everything. Yeah.
You know, they've built something which is like a 30-page manual when you know, you can't even articulate it.
They're trying to answer every question under the sun, and 90% of them don't matter.
Yeah. And so that's the first thing. Business. So therefore the vision becomes unclear, because they drive down. The vision's, you know, the top level piece, right?
Right.
And the plan is how you get there. But if you go too far into the weeds, you forget the vision. So that happens. The second thing I see, which is painful, is that the entrepreneur starts to get too intrinsically focused or internally focused.
Right.
And they don't see what's happening in the market or their customers. And what's happening right now, Mitch, is because of technology and because of, you know, stuff that's happening globally with pandemics and whatever else, the speed of change across markets and customer profiles and all that has never been more quick than it is now.
Right. Ridiculous.
And, you know, I could have product market fit right now, right? And then in 6 months' time, that product is obsolete, because the audience may still be there, but their need has changed, their problem has changed.
And does that mean you didn't kind of keep conscious of what your target market is and needs? That's
precisely,
you're not paying attention to it, right?
Precisely.
You think it's going to always be the same?
So this is still under the first peak, the purpose peak, because the plan, the strategy needs to be externally focused. So have a vision, have a plan, but make sure that you're making decisions which are much more objective using data and metrics.
Okay.
So that's the first piece. So I look at that first, and it's usually the one where I always ask people, so tell me the vision. And they give me some crazy thing. And half the time it's not good enough.
Right.
So that's the first bit.
Now, are you evaluating at this point in order to figure what can I help these people, or if you even want to work with them?
Combination of both, because ultimately it's whether I can help them. And so once I kind of, usually this stage, it's almost an assessment here. I can put a business through an assessment against these six peaks, and I can work out which two of the six need the most attention.
Yeah, like,
and
you want to know how much of a mess is this person? If they're really a mess, then maybe you don't want to take on this challenge.
It's the business. The business. I won't even get to this stage with a company until I've felt that I can work with the leader.
Yeah.
So you'd be surprised how many times I turn things away because I don't believe that it's the right stage or the right situation for me to help. I mean, I'm quite, back to the whole, you know, being a dick or an ass, I'm still very direct. And some people like that and they really engage with that, and other people don't like that. And I'm not trying to be arrogant about it. It's just that I'm not coaching people. I'm mentoring them.
Look, it respects their time and it respects your time. It's not.
Yeah. And also I'm trying to drive acceleration
and growth
here.
It's just business.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not there to. So there's a slight nuance between, you know, people get a little bit kind of confused about what's a coach, what's a mentor. I'm not going to sit there and ask you lots of questions and get you to figure it out.
Right.
If I can see the fastest way between A and B, I'm going to tell you that's what you should do.
Right. So you're more like on my end of the scale. I'm like more of an advisor than I am a mentor and a coach. I'm definitely not a coach.
No, because these are all, I often say, you know, they're tools in the toolbox. They're not titles. Right. Sometimes I'm a coach. Sometimes I'm a mentor. Sometimes an advisor.
Need, right?
Sometimes I'm a consultant.
Yeah.
Right.
But ultimately, I mean, at the end of the day, aren't you really, you're willing to invest your time and maybe your money, right, in the person. I mean, that's why you're evaluating the person first, because if it's not the right person or is, you know, whatever, you don't think he's got what it takes. The rest of it is like, you can fix the company. You just don't need him.
Yeah. And there's a piece where I need to see that person is, you know, they're in that point of where we talked about pain before and pleasure. They're at a point where they are going to do what's needed.
Right. This is they're going to accept enough. What you're saying. They're ready to change.
Yeah. This is important enough. Right. And you know what?
It's more important to you than it is to them. That's not going to work.
Doesn't work. And that's where you see lots of consultants going out there trading time for money. And they're kind of like, you know, they need the work, right? They'll say yes to anybody. And
they're going
to
pay the bills.
And that's not great, because that's where you see the bad rap of this world that I operate in, you know, because people go in there saying they can do stuff. They take the work on. They've never done it.
Right. I'll figure it out later. I need to pay my bills.
No, and I don't believe in that space.
Right.
So
right.
So that's the first one. Let's go through this. The second one is one certainly in your wheelhouse. It's what I call the ability. It comes under profit is the peak, but it's having a cash runway and a relentless focus on profitability. And the cash runway piece is important now more than ever. And I often say that, you know, you've got to have, I try to work to 6 months cash runway in any of the businesses I own, but the minimum for me is three. A lot of the smaller businesses that get in touch with me, you know, particularly through COVID, haven't even had 4 weeks of cash reserves.
Right. That's what cash runway is. It's your reserve. You know, basically you could go 3 months, 4 months without any profits.
Yeah. It's the psychology behind the fact that you're not living on fumes or vapor, because you make different decisions.
Yeah. No kidding. The other decisions you're like, you know, you're on fire in the other situation.
Yeah. Well, some of my clients, you know, who've been diligent with this kind of profit first mentality have been able to take some of that capital, invest it in product development and marketing, pivoted and taken a leap ahead of competitors across COVID. I mean, I've got some clients who have like doubled, tripled their revenue, had the best performance where other businesses are obviously going bust. Now, that's because they've taken that profit first thinking. You could argue they've planned for the best, expected the best, planned for the worst. And then when that situation comes, no one would have predicted a global pandemic, right? But the point is they were ready.
You're going to be the guy that survives.
So that's the second thing. So I don't expect any of the founders necessarily, as I said beforehand, to be financial geniuses. But I do expect them to understand the basics of a profit-first methodology or philosophy in their business.
Do you know the book, Profit First?
Yeah, I've had Mr. Michalowicz on my podcast.
Oh, me too. I just had him on. I love him. He's great.
He's a great guy. He's good because he simplifies all these things.
He does. He makes it digestible for the average guy. And he's just a nice guy too. I mean,
he's a great guy. And he operates at a slightly smaller level. But the point is, even in the businesses I operate, you'd be surprised even the seven-figure businesses who don't often have the discipline around this. So that's the second lens. And again, remember, these lenses, these peaks, as I call them, are what a private equity guy would be looking for too. So it's not just my view. It's kind of the years of working in this space.
Okay, good.
So the third piece is proposition. And this is similar to what we just talked about around the plan. Proposition is making sure that you have a very clearly identified niche or market that you operate in, and you have a clear understanding of the problem that you solve, and that you can articulate the solving of that problem better than anybody else.
Okay.
So a lot of businesses are sold on product capability or proposition capability. And for me, I look for businesses that have a product ecosystem. So if I go in there and say, okay, talk to me about the customer you're trying to serve. Talk to me about the problem that you solve.
Right.
I'm looking then at how clearly differentiated and unique their overall proposition, the product, the service, the experience is. Because this one's a really important one.
Yeah, very important.
They're all really important, but this one.
No, but this is the question of, do you know your customer? Like, you can have a product that's solving a problem. If you don't know who your target market is, your customer, the people that you serve, how can you answer that question?
It's also where innovation lives.
Okay.
And the ability. So, you know, in tech businesses, it can become a little bit more obvious because a lot of them are so focused on the platform or whatever. But even a great service-led business, if they are thinking cleverly around how they're always iterating and changing, that's when they can win. I'll give you an example of a business here in the UK. It was called Innocent Smoothies. The founder is a guy called Richard Reed. Now, they eventually sold out to Coca-Cola, but they were effectively a smoothie company and they bootstrapped everything. But this is where they were clever, right? This is where sort of proposition
marketing.
Is it a
retail chain or?
No, it's a product. It's a
supermarkets or whatever.
Yeah, it does now. They've now diversified and they've got Innocent butter and Innocent produce, other types of things that you'll see on the supermarket shelf, right?
Yeah.
But what they did is it's just a smoothie, right? Like a smoothie shake, right?
Yeah, right.
But the way they did it was really clever, is that they used a community-based marketing approach to build it. So on the packaging, they would have like, you know, 6 bananas, 5 oranges, 3 blueberries were in this. And they did lots of quirky, clever things, and they were constantly iterating around the proposition aligned to what the market was telling them, so that they said that even though they didn't have the money that a Coca-Cola would have, they would never be outthought by Coca-Cola. And so when I'm asking someone about their proposition, their product, their experience, all that stuff, the thing that they're ultimately trying to sell to create value, I'm looking for the passion, I'm looking for the uniqueness, and I'm looking for the, as you said, the external understanding of what their customer really needs.
Did you work with them, Innocent Smoothie? You worked with them?
No, this is a business that was sold before I was doing this stuff. I knew of them in the private equity world.
Right.
They were a massive exit. But it's a great case study of really building something from a customer. You know, we talk about profit first. This is a customer-centric, customer-first philosophy.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's the third one. The fourth one is predictability, and that's the consistent flow of the right customers, the right clients coming into your business, driving recurring revenue. And this is obviously where we start to talk more about the commercial sales and marketing machine. But a lot of businesses get fixated on leads and not sales. They get fixated on, trying to, instead of building recurring revenue, which can be done through subscription if you're B2C, or can be through longer term contracts if you're B2B, they don't necessarily have the model joined up. I've actually thrown out the concept of sales and marketing from all of my businesses, and now we just have customer or client acquisition. And I don't have a gap between the two entities. For me, it's one entity. It's just one single journey. And if you can start to get predictability across that, then you really start to create value. Because as you would know, one of the valuation metrics of a business is recurring revenue.
Big time. Yeah.
And if you can think about that, if you've got a really strong proposition and you've got predictability around how you bring customers in and convert them, that's going to give you a much higher multiple if you decide to exit your business, because it's a machine at that point.
Of course. They don't need you.
There we go.
Yeah.
So the last couple, right? So the fifth one is process. And it's the whole idea that if you think about, you know, what really is a business, it's creating a product, it's taking it to market, it's fulfilling it.
Right.
But so many businesses are still not automating enough through that process. The join ups aren't clear. They're not using enough data, enough metrics. It's not running like clockwork. And, you know, using Mike Michalowicz as an example here, you know, when an engine of a car is tuned, everything just sings. It makes a really beautiful sound. But if there's one cog that's not in tune, the whole thing sounds terrible. You want to be able to get a business. You better be able to evaluate a business to make sure that all the join-ups, all the things that come together have a clear sequence.
Right.
You know, people have clear accountability for the roles. The handoffs are clear. The operating model is defined. And I've been in businesses, particularly where there are creative entrepreneurs who are really good at the proposition and the sales and marketing, but then there's massive inefficiency when it comes to delivery, and therefore they're not profitable enough, and then the whole thing becomes less valuable than what it could be.
Sure. Well, people don't, especially, you know, I'm dealing with smaller local businesses, and cash flow hides a lot of issues. Like, you know, you can be, like you said, having a lot of sales, a lot of volume, you're not paying attention to your profitability, and cash is coming in and out of the door, and you think everything's great until it stops like a pandemic. And then you're like, ooh, and you might be spending 80% of your time on something that's really not profitable because you don't know your numbers and you haven't really, you know, you don't have the process in place. Look, that's why I try and get small business owners to write business plans. A big part of it is taking your basic business plan and then developing operational manuals or operational guides or whatever to running the different parts of your business. I mean, most people can't do that in their head. So, you know what I mean? And I think that, yeah, I mean, you clearly can walk into a business, you know, right away when this guy's sharp and he's an operations guy, that, you know, they're going to get through a lot of things. And a lot of entrepreneurs are not, like you said, they're the creative people. They're the people that came up with the idea. They need an inside partner, an inside guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Gino Wickman in the whole EOS and the traction model,
yeah,
I think simplifies this the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the most simplest way for people to get this is you have the visionary and you have the integrator. So really what I'm looking at when I come into these businesses is the integrator clear? You know, and has the integrator got authority and power as opposed to just the person who the visionary tells to go and do something? So you're looking for that type of, it's partly in the leadership as much as it is in the process.
Sure. Yeah, I understand.
The last one is the obvious one, which is people, and it's deliberately last, but it's having the right caliber and capability in an organization underpinned by a really clear set of values and behaviors that define the culture. And that's something you can usually feel if you walk into a business, certainly when we used to be able to walk into businesses.
Right.
You know, you feel it from the reception, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I've got a slightly different view on this, is that it's not about just having some funky words on a wall. Probably the most important word out of all of those things I said is behaviors, because it's behaviors are the things that people then do on a day in, day out basis, even if the leadership team isn't there, whereas values can be misconstrued and defined poorly. When I was at Getty, we had 7 leadership principles, which are worth looking at, because everyone was measured against these behaviors, these principles. You were fired if you didn't deliver to them. At the end of every meeting, there was a thing that came up where we had to talk about whether we lived the principles in the bloody meeting. It
really
was incredibly prescriptive. But your bonus was defined on it as well. And it took something like 10 interviews to get a job at Getty, and half the time they were just seeing if you had the behaviors that underpin these principles. And the business sold, I don't know, I think it flipped 5 times and sold for billions in the end, because I strongly believe that behaviors-led culture was a key determinant to the success and, as we said, the value of that company.
Right. Well, it has to do with your employees having a clear understanding of what their role is, right, in the company, and being like-minded. A lot of problems are companies develop, right? You got an assistant, and then you get an office manager, and then you hire 2 salespeople, and you got a CFO, COO type of person, and all these people are like separate companies. They're not working together. Then you install systems and processes, but you don't pay attention to whether it supports the people and what they're doing. or it's just a and you're like, here you go, Nick, now you got to use this system. You're like, I don't operate that way. And there's a lot of disconnect, I think, with like-mindedness of employees. You know, it's funny. Do you get the prophet over in England, Marcus Lemonis?
No, but it's so funny. He comes up a number of times because I think what he's done, certainly at the scale he's done, is kind of what I'm moving towards.
Right.
I mean,
he's
doing some
big stuff. But he uses three principles.
Yeah.
Product, process, and people. And he comes into the little shop or whatever. He has money too. It helps. But he fixes all three of those things. And sometimes that means moving people around. Sometimes it means firing people. Sometimes it means hiring different people. But it simplifies the process for and the approach for the average business owner who doesn't have your kind of background or understanding or not, or mine even.
I love his stuff.
Show. Yeah.
I love his stuff. And in fairness,
I'd like to get him on the podcast, but he doesn't return my phone call.
I'd love to. Eventually, I probably will try for that. But it's the Six Peaks have a slightly deeper level. But to be frank, that's what I said to you. Anything I say here, you wouldn't have heard. It's not that you haven't heard this before, but it's about then how that's landed. And as I said, I assess those peaks in a business, and then we work out the areas which need improvement. And then it just becomes a schematic, a blueprint of how you execute against something which is good, but making it great. And then if you start to improve that, it becomes a cycle, and that's how you create value.
So are you brought into a company on a contract basis where you're getting equity in the company, or they're paying you to do that until you actually help them exit and sell the business? Or, I mean,
no, I get asked to do that a lot. But because I'm working with businesses that are a little bit later stage, they've already got investments in the businesses. So I'm not trying to get them from sort of early stage startup to something else where a lot of incubators do. No, I tend to come in and I'll come in as an advisor. Sometimes I'll take a board seat and non-exec role. I will have my business, Scale Up Your Business, has a number of programs. So we have what we call the Growth Accelerator Partnership, which is an assessment and then a kind of almost done for you process where we'll come in. And I've got in my network, I've got some very, very high caliber people. And so they'll come in and they'll work, as I said, triage the problems. What tends to happen though is a lot of my clients, I'll come in and I'll work on that basis. I'll get them motoring. And then they'll ask me to stick around because they'll realize then that a lot of it, everything's about value creation. So they want to sell the business. That's one of the key things. So then they'll say, can you stick around now for the next
That's
2 years?
That's one of the motivations with working with you?
Yeah, because most of my stuff is exits. You know, I've done, 22 exits over the course of the last decade and some big ones. And so often their vision is one of two things. They either want to exit that business and create wealth, or often they want to exit that business or create an empire by bolting things together. So I'll stick around and I'll almost, I don't take too much of a, I sort of sit on the shoulder, if you like, of the entrepreneur and pull a few strings to help them understand where they should focus. And also that's probably where the mindset thing comes in, Mitch. That's where I'll start to work a little bit on the identity of the person.
Right.
Who do you need to become as a leader to build an empire?
Right.
You know, what's the gap? And that's where it becomes a bit more of a personal relationship. And that's usually, to your question about equity, I get asked to stick around and I get a bit of equity to be on the journey. And most people just want to do that because they want me around, but they also value the work that I've done to give them the clarity to be able to get to that position.
So you said you're involved in about 7 businesses right now?
I own 7 companies.
Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, I've got different things. I invest. I'm a big believer in portfolio and multiple streams of income.
Okay.
So my main area of focus is Scale Up Your Business. So that's where we work with entrepreneurs and investors doing what we said around the Six Peaks. I have a holding company called the Fielding Group, which is where we make our own investments and acquisitions from that.
Okay. It's a private equity group, basically.
It's a private equity group, yeah. Right. It's and Scale Up Your Business, if you like, is a Fielding Group company. So we've got that.
Makes sense.
We've got a recruitment firm where we utilize that recruitment. If it's funny actually, because it's becoming more fractional support now as opposed to permanent recruitment, but we have a capability to go out there and find individuals for businesses. We have
on
an
a
investment
fractional basis, like kind of like Trevor Anderson does.
Yeah, it so used to be more permanent.
Bringing a CFO in. You hire
it's more fractional. It's fractional. I call it fractional support now. And we've also got an investment in a virtual assistant business that does offshore work across Europe and Southeast Asia.
Okay.
My wife and I have an investment in a Amazon online retail business. We also have her business, which is a media business, which is called Flying with a Baby, which is turning over six figures now. Small business, but it's basically her leveraging affiliate revenues from businesses like Booking.com and again Amazon, all based on leveraging content. She's got, forget the figure, but in the hundreds of thousands of visitors going to her site every single month. Of course, that's been disrupted a bit by travel and COVID.
Right, of course. But she's got an online community, basically, that she's got affiliate relationships with the products that she recommends.
Absolutely, yeah. And so influences. That's why we moved into online retail off the back of that as well. And then I've got a separate coaching practice, which I invest in as well, which is slightly separate to that sort of thing. And so that's the main bulk of it. But if you ladder all those things together, I've got a couple of holding companies. But my whole vision for me personally is I'm trying to create an empire of businesses. Back to the idea that I still think that empires can create good and create positive impact. It's not just about making money.
Right.
And in the process of setting up a foundation around that as well.
Oh, nice. Well, I mean, if you're a leader with a conscience, it doesn't have to be, you know, just scorched earth policy.
No.
You can still make money, a lot of money, and do good things for people. I don't believe the other is true. Right. Yeah.
That's why I like, I mean, I've used the word a few times on the conversation tonight of empire, and I use it deliberately because I want to reignite that word a bit, because I think sometimes people think of it in a bad way. They think, you know, someone's an empire builder or it's Genghis Khan doing whatever. I think, you know, creating scale, significant scale, allows the ability to create, you know, greater impact. And so for me, I'm looking for business leaders who are successful, but they want to do more. They really want to push things out. They're not playing small, because it's what I'm doing, right?
Right, right.
And I want to be able to help people on that journey, because that's where I think entrepreneurship, as I said, is a force for good to drive progression and prosperity. I think that's still under-leveraged. And I think the more that we can embrace that, particularly as we go through change, I think it's going to create a lot of good things.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.